when you walk through an art museum, what happens?
You see some interesting things, you see some not so interesting things, and if you're like us at all, you're probably a little bit sleepy.
Well, grab a cafecito and listen up. It's Art Slice, a palatable serving of art history. We are both artists, so we look at art history through that perspective. We cover the artists you know and those that have been ignored for so many different reasons.
We look at the context of the time, we compare it to today.
We don't dumb anything down, but, and this is a big but,
hey-o,
we like to have a good time, okay? Nos gusta to goof around, all right? We have hungry pantry moms might startle you. It's a long story.
We feed them art materials. Art is just a visual language that is open for anyone to interpret.
So if this all sounds good to you, join us on Art Slice, a palatable serving of art history.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast, and we're chatting with Jerry Shepherd, a writer, a thinker, world creator. Jerry, welcome to the podcast. So excited to have you on.
Ken, I'm so excited to be with you. Thanks so much for opening this conversation.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Prior to jumping on right here, listeners, Jerry and I were talking about, we're talking about writing, and being a writer is, at least for me, in my opinion, you know, a particular thing to do, to try to get the right words and link them together and kind of create worlds. And Jerry is somebody who's done that throughout her life. And when Jerry and I were talking, I was saying, I'm just so interested in what it's like to write and to work on that craft and to teach it and to collaborate. So Jerry, I wanted to jump right in and ask you about, writing and your new work At Fault and creating Fault Lines series, which is a big jump for you. We'll get into that, but so bring us into right now. Like, what's going on with you doing this, and what are you creating?
Okay, so it's really interesting when I decided to, and again, we'll get into the leap that this was, but when I decided to get into fiction, I was really burnt out from the writing world that I had been in, and I really wanted to reconnect to the things that made me excited and just kind of lit my soul up. And I remember just really loving science fiction when I was a kid. And I actually was reading the Expanse series by James S. A. Corey, amazing partnership duo that they're Hugo Award winning, really incredible writing. And it got me excited again. I said, this is what I have to write. This is what I have to write. I have to go in this science fiction world. And I had no clue what to write at that time. Yeah. But it was in the beginning of the pandemic and when the race protests were going on around the country at the same time and just so much divisiveness over so many topics that I actually didn't even start from a place of building the world. Where I started from was this place of, I felt like I was all alone in the center lane and like all of my friends on the left and on the right and on the extreme and the top and the bottom and wherever, they all were just against each other. And I really wanted to focus on what our common humanity was and how we can connect. And I feel like I've always done that in my writing, but that was the seed that started this whole story. And that's why the motto in the first book is actually be gloriously human. And I really wanted to focus on what brings us together as a human people.
Yeah, I love that. Be gloriously human. And thanks for bringing it to the backdrop. Of course, as I mentioned to you, I lived out in Wisconsin for a bit. You know, Wisconsin politics are pretty darn wild because the world and sometimes the nation kind of peeps in and says, what the heck's going on? And of course, steeped, history of conflict. And it's just, it was interesting for you to talk about, within that. And I know in reading about the book and the series is that what we're looking at the way you describe it is kind of more of the connections amongst humans from different type of perspectives. And of course, what type of world exactly? Let's get into the grit. What does the world look like that you create? And tell us what it looks like, what's going on in it, and like what's the problem?
I love this. This is kind of like you're going to get a little bit of the elevator pitch, if you will, here. So it's a globally, racially, gender, and age diverse ensemble of characters, and they are telling the story of Earth after the melt. However, unlike so many stories where disaster happens, this is not dystopian. It's not apocalyptic. You know, humans have done what humans have always done. We've adapted. And so there are city ships out at sea where people live. There are impossibly tall skyscrapers where people live. The real struggle is still between humans. It's between, you know, there, we've got a socialist society. We've got a fiercely independent society. There are off-world colonists, indigenous nations, the mobs and mafias, they've moved out onto the waters too. Those are now fleet families. And so, you know, there's still a lot of, it's a lot of that geopolitical division and kind of like factional groupings, much like you would see in like, you know, a George R. R. Martin book where it's like the groupings of people. Mind you, within that, because it's science fiction, I have been able to have so much freaking fun with like creating some really cool things. Like, there's tsunamic defense. Like, how have we learned to fight against Mother Nature, even as Mother Nature is taking over, you know, taking her throne back from us? And, you know, what sorts of energy resources do we have? And how are people traveling? And what do humans look like? You know, there's a little bit of a transhuman element where it's like people are getting different types of implants and whatnot. And honestly, that a lot of this stuff, what's crazy is in this world build, is it really exists today. It's just, I just take a lot of today and I expand on it, or I bring a little imagination to it. And this is maybe another topic. I don't want to sidebar too much, but I used a lot of niche experts to help create this world in a way where that pseudoscience and that pseudo future could have buy-in and be very real.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. That's excellent to do. I know I can speculate about science and other things in my head, but I know going up against any pro or somebody well-versed in it, I'm going to defer very quickly.
I hate those bad descriptions you read on like the three sci-fi movies that you get on whatever streaming service you have. And as soon as I'm like, one line in and I can't even buy in, I'm like, oh God, I just don't want to be that. Don't let me be that. Don't let me be the people who have to like blow up the core of the earth in order to cool it or something strange like that.
Yeah. And, you know, the making sure that everybody understands the differences between event horizon and wormholes and things like that. And just to be so bringing in that science and, of course, in the future there, want to pop out a little bit and talk about the conceptual, Jerry. Okay. And everybody, definitely check out, the Fault Line series. And Jerry and I will tell you how to access that later on, but, just a wonderful start, to the series. And of course we're here with the author, Jerry Shepherd. Jerry, going to hit you with the big question. Always talking art and philosophy on the podcast. The big thing I know you were excited and you had been thinking about, in creating now and what you're doing, over time in writing is what is art? What have you been trying to create? I know you've been trying to, you know, create art. So what is it? What is it?
For me, art is what connects us. I believe that we are, I mean, not just I believe, science believes, study and research believes that we are made as humans to connect. And, you know, not to get too like weird and sciencey on you, but there's...
Oh, weird and sciencey is fine on this podcast.
All right. So there's like, in our actual human brains, there's like white matter and gray matter. And like, the white matter, and I'm sure there's going to be some neurologist who says I've got like these two mixed up.
We'll fix it in the notes if we need
to. But one of them is it's like kind of creating like the silos in your brain. Like, okay, this is the part of your brain that's just for language, and this is the part of your brain that's just for math. The other part, that gray part, I believe, is the part that causes connection. And it helps the different parts of our brains connect. And that actually is fueled by story. And when we have connections like that, then we're better able to connect with other humans. And I just believe that I have such a passion for story. I have such a passion for using story to connect people, to make sure that they can relate to one another. And that, to me, that is art. Art is this, it's this place where humans find commonality. And, you know, I may like look at you, Ken, and be like, oh, you know, you're out there on the West Coast, and, you know, and I'm, you know, here in the Midwest, and, you know, you're a guy and I'm a woman. And there's like, we could probably, and our society is lined up for us to find all of the ways that you and I might be different.
Yeah.
But as soon as we start talking, even when we were just talking before we started recording today, you start to find commonalities. Sure. And when you do that, there's compassion and there's connection, and it's honestly, it's the only way that I think we can move forward as people. So that's, for me, art is stories, and stories are there to help us connect.
Yeah. I love that. I loved when I've been doing the show and talking to different types of artists, but talking about stories, about stories in particular. And I think thinking about writing in literature for me, and I don't delve deep into it on the show because I kind of cover a lot of different things, but literature is just so foundational for me, I think, maybe in terms of identity and imagination, or thinking about what is possible. You've been writing your whole life, Jerry, and working and doing this. I want to ask a question. I'm also like a labor guy. I work for a union, and I think about work and about work that people do and creativity. What is it like to write for hundreds and thousands of hours, as you know, as a craft, as a work to do? What's that experience like for you in doing it?
Whew. It's it's a roller coaster. So I would say that it's a little, I mean, for me, I believe it's my purpose, and I've tried to not write at times when writing has itself burned me out, and I'm not successful at that. I can't help it. I have to write. Like I'm talking to you, and I'm like, it makes me, you know, ideas light up, and I have to write them down. But yeah, it's, I think anybody who goes into an art has to go into it for that love of that art. And I don't care whether you're painting or acting or singing or writing or, you know, creating music. It doesn't matter. Sculpting, whatever, you have to go into it for the art. And I think there are a lot of artists who go into their craft because they want to be rich, they want to be famous.
Sure.
You know, those are like these two myths that have been fed to us, specifically in our Western culture. And you have to know that if you're using your craft as a business, it is a business. You're going to have to work. And, you know, I remember it was 2016. I wrote 8 full-length books, and I,
in one year.
And
whoa.
I was crying. I remember sitting at my computer and just writing. And this was when I was in my co-writing world. And I'm like, okay, I have this deadline. And I physically could not keep my eyes open. And so my eyes were closed and I was typing, and I had carpal tunnel so severely in both of my hands that I was crying as I was typing. And
yeah,
it was total burnout.
Yeah.
But every time that I've burned out in writing, I've, as opposed to giving up writing because I just can't, I've changed directions and I've said, okay, well, how else can I do this writing? You know, what else can I do with this writing? But yeah, it's a job. And as much as it's a passion and I love it and I love the craft and I love the art, you know, you're going to have marketing, you're going to have to deal with publishing, you're going to have to deal with distribution, you're going to have to pay the stinking bills. You're going to, if you go on the publishing side, I had a publishing house for a while. You're going to have to pay your author's royalties. You're going to have to pay your editors. I mean, like it's a job. And, and so, you really have to take that into account. And for a lot of people, if they don't want to accept that, that's okay. But then your writing can be a hobby. And I, again, I think all of those same things could apply to any of the arts.
Yeah, thanks for a peek inside there. Jerry, one of the things I love to do more than anything is going to comic cons or science fiction conventions. So like recently, in the last week or two, there was the Rose City Comic Con in Portland, Oregon. And I tell you, it was such a thrill for me because I was able to run into five or six folks that I've had on the podcast. But not only that, you know, being around authors and writers that I really enjoyed, and just it's so much fun for me. And I know you and I have chatted just a tiny bit about how, you know, with the, you know, the series you're creating and moving into this, that it's opened up kind of the world of science fiction or that mm-hmm. field, which is a fascinating area. What are your just open like impressions as far as the sure. newness of the experience and what you've learned and seen?
It has been an adventure. So I came from nonfiction primarily. I mean, a few other things, or when I did my children's books, I was in a lot of school events. So this is not that. And so, it's at once both an intimidating and a welcoming environment at the same time. And you have to go in with an open mind, and you hate to speak to stereotypes because stereotypes can be damaging, but they also exist for a reason. And there's something to be said about the sci-fi conventions, the comic cons, the fan conventions, that there are a lot of people there who maybe weren't accepted in other parts of society, whether it was sure. in their school or in their, you know, communities or, you know, whatever it is. This is a place when you go to these conventions where like everybody is accepted. And if you are somebody who can be a part of that movement of accepting others, you can really do well in them. But yeah, it's, you know, you might have somebody in a full fur costume with a dragon head come up and like, you know, take your hands in theirs, and you're like, I don't even know what's happening right now.
Yeah,
that's maybe a real experience. But then you also will have just an incredible like mutual support amongst the creators. And it's been a lot of fun. And once I realized that I didn't need to like put on any kind of persona when I went to these, and I was just going to be me. And honestly, you know, when people see like the middle-aged suburban woman at these things, you know, I'm actually the odd man out, but they're just as accepting of me. And,
everybody Everybody fits there, right?
You really do. And it's just, once you put yourself in that mindset to to be a part of that. It's just, it's a very joyful environment.
Yeah, it's, I do, you know, it's like any community, there's aspects of it that, you know, run foul and some that are super, you know, I think about the kind of, you know, elements, I think maybe with the misogynistic elements, sometimes you'll find deeper, you know, in the crevices of the sci-fi and gaming, things like that. Not to tarnish everybody, but, you know, it, like any community has its bits and pieces. But I think one of the things overall in the environment is kind of like how a lot of interesting and wild ideas, you can kind of communicate them like more freely, right? Because we think about our interactions in general society a lot of times. It's not like, you know, you're going to wave high your freak flag. Like, I mean, I guess I do. I made a life out of doing it, I guess. But like, not everybody's going to be like, I want to talk about this, you know, weird thing. And it's just, the air feels a little bit freer for me. I mean, that's been my impression. Yeah.
It is. And it's really interesting. Like, I was opposite one gentleman and at one, I don't remember, it was somewhere in Iowa. I have done so many this year, I've lost track. But he was a university professor at like the University of Chicago, huge science guy. But he had this zine that was all like, it was down the research rabbit hole. And like, it just freaking cracks me up. And like, it's the kind of stuff that only would exist in a space like this. And he talks about, like, he has one called Space is Sexy or Is It? And it talks about what sex would actually be like in space versus the way they romanticize it in like every sci-fi show ever. And it's hilarious.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, okay, this would only exist in this space. And I've actually used some of his research, you know, to influence the second book in the Fault Line series even. So there are things that exist in that space that belong in the world and that wouldn't exist otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. I like a lot of the DIY elements you find, you know, within the zines. And I got to admit for myself, I don't think it was a matter of snobbery or anything. I just wasn't in close contact with a lot of like independent presses and zines and things like that. And as I've done the podcast, I've become a lot more connected into these phenomenal independent creations that are just fantastic. They're just independent and small and you just happen upon them. And zines and kind of mini presses and a lot of that has really kind of pulled me in. And just I'm pausing at those sections and spending my time there, where in the past is, you know, I just kind of went more quickly by it. You seen some of that development for yourself or coming in contact with it at the con?
I have. And this, some of this is also from my experience just in the publishing world in general. I tell people I sort of took a lot of back and side doors into publishing because I've worked with traditional publishers, but they brought me in to like write for other people, you know? So it was like, I was always kind of like backdooring it into like the traditional publishers. And I kind of have an analogy about the publishing world. Yeah. It's like for decades and decades, people, there were gatekeepers behind this huge, beautiful gated community. And it was the Big Six, then the Big Five, and now it's the Big Four, which should tell you something in this gated publishing community. And, you know, you couldn't get in and they were the guards of the gate and there was nothing you could do. But every once in a while, there might be somebody like on the edge of that gated community who'd look over the edge and go, oh, but hey, I like what that person there is doing. So let me invite them in. So these are some of like those niche publishers and the side doors, if you will. And then after a while, people just got tired of it. And they're like, fine, you don't want us in your gated community. We're going to build a tent city right outside of it. And I think little by little, like the people on the edges of the gated community are like, dang, they look like they're having fun over there. And I think it's just, you know, at the end of the day, it's, the gated community still exists, but now there are some of these people who will invite other people in behind the gate, even though they didn't follow the protocols to earn their way there.
Yeah.
And there's this, you know, rock and tent city. So just, you know, you don't have to, there's not just one way into publishing anymore. And, you know, just find your neighborhood and have your party. And that's what I think you got to do. Today I do traditional and I do independent. And, you know, it depends on the book.
Yeah.
It depends on who I'm trying to reach. There are like 1,000 things that play into that. And, you know, everybody's like, hey, I want to be on the shelves of Barnes and Noble. Okay, well, you can do that. That's great. There are 1,000 other avenues that are just as worthy. And it depends on what each individual artist wants, what that story needs, where that audience is going to find that story. And I see a lot of that independent stuff at the conventions. And some of these people are like, they're the best authors and artists.
You've run into geniuses, you know, the genius on the corner, yeah. You know, on the corner. Right. Mm-hmm. It's great. Jerry, talking writing, talking literature. We talk a lot about, you know, some of the components of, you know, the business around it, but, you know, jumping back in deeper into the art and the type of writers maybe that where you lose your mind over, like you're possessed, like that type of thing. For me, that's always the biggest draw from when I was younger, that I will lose myself in the writing I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
For me, as writers like Faulkner, Kathy Acker, a lot of science fiction, Octavia Butler. I'm a big fan of Kerouac. I love a lot of Victorian literature and Henry James. And this is the stuff like I would devour, and you're a writer and people would devour your stuff because it's like, oh, it's mm-hmm. so inspiring. Who's that for you? What are the type of writers where you like, you want to talk writing, you got to be talking about some of these folks. Who's that for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say if I'm going to hop on like today, totally James S.A. Corey, which is actually two different people. It's Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. And I hope I got that right. It's they're a partnership that wrote the Expanse series. And yes, they are definitely my number one right now.
Yeah.
And I can tell you some of those reasons why, but I'm trying to think about some other ones. Like growing up, I was such a little dreamy girl. I read all of like the L.M. Montgomery, you know, Anna Green Gables series.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I know. Right. I totally dated myself there and of course I read all of my kids. We read all of the Harry Potters. We read all of the Mockingjays and Hunger Games and all of that. So when I'm giving you like these different names, you can hear I'm kind of all over the map. I also, you know, I like an occasional really, oh my gosh, Laura Hillenbrand oh my gosh, Seabiscuit and Unbreakable. Like I can get into a really great biography too.
Hillenbrand's a hell of a writer. Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah.
And you want to read about a bit of a tortured soul when it comes to the process around her writing.
I'm gonna check that out. Thank you. Yeah.
Really, really interesting stuff. But I just don't have one thing. I mean, there are so many things. I would say that I tend to be a really slow reader, very slow, because I will read a line I like, and then I'm like, ooh, I gotta read that line again. And I'll read it again and again. So I'm very, very slow at reading. I would say the very, very first book ever when I was younger that just absolutely captured me. I'm usually embarrassed to admit, because you're going to hear the name of the author and you're going to think something very different than who he is.
All right.
Battlefield Earth.
Yeah.
Which I read when I was like 14.
Yeah.
And by L. Ron Hubbard.
I know there's the whole Scientology thing, but I mean,
not
as a writer, no, as a writer, I mean, he's somebody to be reckoned. somebody to be reckoned with as a writer, you know, no doubt.
It really was. And the movie was horrible. So anybody who's hearing this, who's thinking,
I recall that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It had nothing to do. And what's interesting is I find that here I am, well, gosh, like 30 some years later after the first time I read that book, and I still see some of his themes make their way into my own writing. And, but yeah, it's hard to say that there's just one that I like. I love reading. I'm a very, very slow reader because I want to like eat and taste every single word.
Yeah.
That's on the page.
Yeah. I totally understand that. Totally understand that, particularly, in the art that you make. Jerry, I wanted to ask you another one, just one related to art. When you talked about art was, and I really love when you were talking about stories and, you know, the communication component, you know, both as an artist and in the art itself. What do you think the role of art is right now? And just one little comment before I let you answer. You got the elements in your book, in your series of kind of temperature rising, climate change, and things like that. And I interject that within, you know, what you've created, just with the ideas. What is the role of art? And is there something now that the role of art might be different? You know what I'm saying? If you identify climate change or any of other the world ills as being at a, you know, at that state. So role of art, and is it different right now today in September 2022?
Art plays a role in having very important conversations. I don't know that it's different than it's always been. There's the famous play Our Town. It's Thornton Wilder.
Oh, yeah. Lovely.
I mean, And he has this line, I'm not going to get it exact, so anybody listening, look it up, because he says it far better. But basically he says that history is told by the artists. And if you think about that throughout the course of history, it's true, you know, like the musicians and the concertos that were told, Shakespeare, who told his stories that mocked the royalty, but really kind of highlighted that divide between the classes of that time. You know, the Greeks and Romans telling the story of their belief system through the stories and the visual art around their gods, and how, you know, the gods would play and the people would pay, you know, I mean, yeah. Sort of. So I think that role of art leading to the conversation has always existed. I think that generationally, where we currently are, this is a sad thing to say as an artist, I think there are a lot of people who abuse that. I know particularly in like the late 90s, but even to a certain extent, still continuing today, there are people who wanted that shock factor in their art, whether it was on a stage or in a book or in an art museum, you know, where they're not really causing a conversation. They're just causing people to be shocked. And I don't know that there's productivity in that. But if you're actually creating conversation between people, if you're actually, you know, trying to build bridges and instead of walls with your art, then it's serving its current purpose. And then, you know, historically looking back, hopefully some of the best art will serve that longer term purpose of telling history. And I guess that's that I do believe that. And I believe like there's so many times that we want to, our news is so stinking sensationalized and everything is just so extreme and divided. And what causes extremities and division is numbers. You know, oh, this many people died from this, and, you know, this many people that, and this many dollars, and this many, you know, whatever diseases are, it's all numbers. And what I found, you know, and particularly highlighted in these pandemic years that we have found ourselves, is that when you take the numbers aside and instead you tell the stories, people listen. And so, yeah, it creates conversation in ways that find unity instead of highlight division.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really good instinct. And I also think it's a really good fertile ground in general, you know, in discussing that, right, as far as like access to space. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things you brought up is really interesting. I mean, I think when you talk about shock or shock for its own sake, I think you get right into the debate is, yeah, sometimes, you know, what is underneath it all? And then at other times, you know, artists shock, you know, the whatever seems to be around. I think of when you think of a political protest, I one of the historical examples I think is one of Velázquez's pieces in the British Museum, and it's a Venus depiction, and the suffragettes in the 1910s or maybe 1920s in England, I believe it was one or two of them, ran up to it and cut it through, you know, with a knife. And I've always thought about that because I think it's just so unresolved. Whereas I'm telling you the story right now in 2022 about a political act that they did. So like it works in the sense of that, but you know, in the sense of not even traditional outrage, but just like art lover outrage, being like, you can't put knives through a Velázquez, like don't do that. But then when you do it, it creates the thing. So yeah. I think it's always fascinating, the, you know, the shock of the art or around the art. And
absolutely.
I think even lately people have been throwing these cakes at everything, at the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. Where somebody,
oh, that's right. Yeah. I'm like, why?
It's a wild, wild idea, not to take us way off. The role of art, yes. Jerry, big question, name of the show, you can go any direction with this, but like, why is there something rather than nothing from your perspective? Like why?
Yeah. Honestly, otherwise what's the point? You know, I feel like, the something is something beyond ourselves. And if there's nothing beyond ourselves, then none of us have a point. None of us have a point to do anything but what feels good in the moment, what, you know, is self-serving. And there would be zero reason to not just like go out and take what I want and do what I want with no thought to who's hurt in the process if there was nothing. So there has to be something. There has to be something. There has to be a reason that we don't just serve self in this world that we live in. And if we're not just serving ourselves, then we have to serve others. There has to be something. There has to be something that connects us, something that makes us want to make the world better. And again, if not, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if that's a...
No, that's the philosophy end point. Like, what's the point of it? I think one of the funniest pieces about these absurd questions, and thank you for playing, Jerry, these absurd questions. I've always found this is, and there's some people who think this about philosophy. I like to laugh, and I do think a lot of things are just fundamentally absurd. And, you know, mm-hmm. So that's part of me. And philosophy is so serious and so important until it breaks down, and then it's not, and you just end up laughing a lot around it. So it's like the idea of philosophy is therapy, art is therapy, morning pages is therapy, writing is therapy, or work and work. Jerry Shepherd, where do we go to find your stuff? We talked about the At Fault book. Tell us where to find, like, your website, get that book, what format's in, all that stuff.
Okay, I like to try to make it really easy for everybody. So I just made it atfaultbook.com. When that's the first book in the series, but we'll be maintaining that website as it grows as a series. So it's atfaultbook.com. We make it nice and easy. That takes you to my site. Currently, it's available in print as well as an ebook. We are producing the audiobook this fall. I'm so excited. So it'll probably be out. Yeah, it'll be out hopefully before the second book, which should be out next spring. And we also have, I have an amazing on-retainer artist who is creating all of the incredible artifacts, the maps and the flags.
Love
and
it.
the portraits, and some of those are going to be found there too. But yeah, atfaultbook.com, that takes you to not just everything At Fault, but everything, you know, you can click to my backlist of books as well.
Excellent. Well, that makes it nice and easy. Everybody check it out. And I think one of the things I find too is when, you know, here at this point, when you're starting out this series, it's always good to get in at the beginning, I find. Sometimes it's tough to catch up. So get in on the Fault Lines series with Jerry Shepherd and check out the website there to find out about all her other work and things that she creates and thinks about. And I got to tell you, Jerry, it's so nice to chat with you from a place of the country of the United States that I love, the Midwest and Wisconsin, where I used to live. So it's a great pleasure to reach you out from there, and just to hear about, you know, just meeting you and your new, you know, adventures, and just like really just talking about doing some cool stuff, like creating what you want, and you know, just kind of you know, sharing your thoughts on philosophy. Really appreciate you coming on and, you know, enduring questions like something, why is this something rather than nothing, Jerry.
That's right. Ken, I promise I'll throw some of those back at you the next time we get to talk like this. I'm always grateful to speak to another creative. And you know, I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jerry. Best of luck with everything, and it'd be good to keep in touch. And everybody check out all the other art Jerry was referring to in you know, the different pieces in addition to the book. And thanks again, Jerry, and thanks for everything you create.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it.
All right.
This is Something Rather Than Nothing.